Although New Guinea was and still is famous as a place of headhunters, the natives where we were not headhunters. And thanks to the Japanese, the natives were very much in favor of the Allies. And what I mean is that the natives didn't know anything about the war, particularly what it was about or care about it, who won or who lost. But the Japanese had been foolish enough to be brutal to the natives, and wherever they came in contact with them, and the natives hated them. So with very few exceptions, and there were some exceptions, but with few exceptions, the natives would go to great lengths when they ran into air crews who had been shot down in the jungle to get them home again. And they had a good deal of success in that. And these natives would go to a great deal of trouble and just shift people along relay after relay from village to village till they got them back. Occasionally, a native would turn somebody into the Japanese, but that mostly didn't happen. If you think about it, you'll also realize that air crews who flew out of England, for example, once they got well into the air, could see France. Whereas in New Guinea, we had to fly well over 100 miles, and sometimes a good deal more than that, before we ever even got over enemy territory by this time. So you might not go down in enemy territory at all, but you'd still be 100, 125 miles from home. So with a bad engine or something, it was often a problem. About this time, I started on occasional missions to lead the squadron, being somewhat senior by this time. And I remember I started a big controversy there because I insisted that on my flights, people should fly with what were considered by them to be excessively low RPMs and excessively high manifold pressures. I'm not going to attempt to go into explain what this meant, but this was considered to be a dangerous practice. It meant, according to many people, that you were overworking the engine and would ruin it. And although the result of it, this was, and the reason that I insisted on doing it, was that it was a tremendous gas saver. It increased your range markedly. And but this raised a great storm of protest, and everybody went complaining that that I was ruining all their engines, and this should be stopped. Now, the fact of the matter was that the settings that I was using and recommending came straight out of the P-40 pilot's manual, which gave you all sorts of power settings for all sorts of situations, and there wasn't a thing in the world wrong with it. But they thought so, and it was I was ordered to stop doing this. But I remember I went one night, as a matter of fact, to see the line chief. Now, our line chief, who was a master sergeant, an old-time master sergeant, named Sergeant Double. And there wasn't very much about airplane engines that Sergeant Double didn't know. In fact, he knew too much for our own good, meaning that after a while they took him away from us because he was too valuable to spend on just one squadron. But at this time, he was still with us. And I remember going over to his tent one night with some other guys. And we sat on his bunk talking, and I told him what my problem was. And he said, you aren't doing any harm to those engines whatsoever. And all this is a lot of baloney. But he said, you're going to have to stop it because all the other pilots think it's a bad habit. And so it was stopped. But it was not a smart idea to stop it. And I'll tell you what. I hadn't left New Guinea very long in early 1944 before the Air Corps sent no less a man than Charles Lindbergh over there to New Guinea to teach pilots what had become to be known as cruise control. Well, cruise control was nothing more or less than doing exactly what I had recommended all the time. And it was a critical thing to learn over there because there was so much overwater flying and over jungle flying, and so many crews were lost, not to enemy action particularly, indirectly anyway, but just because of not being able to make it back home and going down in a hostile environment. But that myth persisted for a very long time, and I I worked with a man in the VA who flew P-38s in North Africa and in Germany and in Italy. And I remember his telling me one day, he said, you people over there, it was reported to us, were doing something they taught us never, never to do. You were flying those airplanes with high manifold pressures and low RPMs. Well, I didn't say anything. I just looked at him because he had been schooled in this old thing. Now, it's obvious that you could overdo that, and you could, I suppose, damage an engine, of course, but not at the settings that I had recommended or that Lindbergh had people use. No harm came from it at all, and saved an awful lot of gas. But anyway, that was a little thing that went on at that time and caused a lot of muttering and grumbling, mostly against me. Less than a month after I had gotten back from Australia, I was sent on leave to Sydney for a week. It was a mostly uneventful time, and as well as I can remember now, it rained a great deal of the time. What I mainly remember about that trip down south was that we stopped for a night on the way back at Townsville. And it just happened that that afternoon, standing around at the field there, I happened to be present when entire group of B-24s arrived from Hawaii. There were two air forces in the Pacific at that time. There was the 7th Air Force, which was based in Hawaii, and the 5th Air Force, which was in Australia, New Guinea. And this B-24 group, I suppose, had been transferred from Hawaii, though maybe it came from the States. But anyway, it arrived at Townsville this afternoon when I was there, and it was an awesome sight. I don't care how you look at it. They had all these airplanes coming in one after the other, and they landed and landed and landed. And they parked them here and parked them there and lined them up on either side of the runway. I wonder if I haven't mentioned this before. Maybe I have. I'm not sure. But anyway, it was a tremendous sight. I've seen a similar sight some years later when at Bradley Field a group of B-17s came back from England. And it was the same thing again. They just came and came and came and came and came and landed one right after the other after the other. All those airplanes, all those engines, all those propellers spinning, it was some sight. The only thing equal to it I remember seeing was being at an airfield in Fort Moresby when a group of B-24s was taken off for a bombing mission. And they were lined up nose to tail on the taxiway, taking off one behind the other as fast as they could. But all those airplanes, all those propellers and all those engines, nose to tail, just moving up foot by foot by foot and taking off. And it took them a long time to get all those airplanes in the air, even though they were wasting no time. It was impressive. We used to get receive broadcasts from the Japanese from time to time. And it was amazing what those people knew. I remember one instance, for example, when the 7th Squadron had just moved over to Dobadura, and this woman announcer was on the radio that night, Radio Tokyo or whatever it was, said, well, the 7th Squadron has moved over to Dobadura, and they're now in a nice camp in the woods down by the river, and blah, blah, blah. And all this was quite accurate and true. But usually they were kind of amusing. They played a lot of nice music. And they would announce these different musical selections. One time she said, well, boys, here's an old favorite, one you used to know long before the Southwest Pacific meant anything to you at all. And another time she said, the next is a piece you used to hear on your automobile radio on those lovely moonlight nights back home when you and your girl drove around and were happy. All in the days before gas was rationed and when moonlight nights didn't mean the horrible agony of Japanese bombs. And sometimes they'd say, you American boys down in the Southwest Pacific, are you happy? You know you aren't. You know you'd like to be home with your family and your friends. Back home with good food, lots of gas and rubber, and no war to think about. Here's a record that will help bring back those days to you. And they'd go on and on with this stuff, which was really quite entertaining to listen to. Aside from the fact, as I already said, the music was quite nice. They made extraordinary claims for things and were always telling us how they'd shot us down and so on when nobody had been shot down at all. But sometimes they would goof up. Sometimes they would try to this wasn't Radio Tokyo, but somebody much closer, and they would try to turn back a bombing mission by pretending to be the radar people giving official instructions. And I was on one mission escorting some B-24s somewhere once when I heard them. And they told us to turn back, go back. The orders had been changed. The trouble was they got the code names wrong. And so their message didn't make any sense for that reason. And whoever was leading the mission recognized that and just ignored it. Also about this time, the Navy had some PT boats down there, and they used to go out every night after dark and go up and down the coast, up the coast, really, I guess, hunting for the Japanese barges. And the barges didn't dare move in the daytime. It wasn't safe. There were too many fighter planes around to get away with that. But as soon as it got dark, then they would go up the coast and up and down the coast, I reckon. And these PT boats would go out there and try to catch them. And I talked to a PT boat skipper once who went on those missions, and he said he had been on one night when they came on this barge, and the minute the two got in sight of one another, the message came over the radio and said, according to this guy, he said, not Japanese barge, Melican barge, Melican barge, not Japanese, Melican. Well, they sank it. All during this time, there had been a good many episodes of combat with the Japanese Zeros and bombers by the 7th Squadron, but I was never on any of them. And I used to curse and fume about that, but that's the way it was. We had a guy with us who later became one of the bigger aces of the U.S. Air Force in World War II, and I remember one day when he announced to the operations officer that he wasn't going to go on the mission if I was going to go. He said, if Harry's going to go, I'm not going to go. And the guy said, why? And he said, because if he goes, nothing will happen. Nothing ever happens when he goes on a mission, and I'm just wasting my goddamn time. And if you're going to send him, then don't send me, because I got better things to do than just fly around for nothing. And that was Bob DeHaven, who is still alive and well today. And I see him occasionally. About this time, which was mid-October, on one of these combats that the squadron got into when I was not along, I wasn't even flying that day, my tent mate, Lieutenant Suckup, that I detested so, was apparently shot down. He never returned. Nobody ever saw what happened to him. He just never came back. And if I'm going to be entirely honest, I'm going to say, not that I was glad he got shot down. Of course, I wasn't that unfeeling. But I was not sorry to see him gone. I detested that man. Just detested him. And having him live in the same tent was a hardship. And I'm going to tell you that his disappearance was a relief as far as I was concerned. And that was true of some other people in the squadron. Meaning I wasn't the only one who was not sorry to see the last of him. He was a mean bastard, and I remember he got in a knife fight with somebody one night, and both of them cut each other up and around the face with these knives. Happily, I wasn't there to see all that. Anyway, he was gone. One afternoon, we went up to patrol over some Navy ships. There were 8 destroyers and a bunch of landing barges way up the coast at a place named Finchhoven. And before we could get home, the weather closed in, and we couldn't get home. Fortunately, the Americans by this time had a base of sorts at a place called Nadsab, which was still in the clear, and we landed there and spent the night under wretched conditions. They were not much accommodations. They had tents, and that was all. And I remember I slept on a stretcher on the ground without a mosquito bar. And the tent got so filled with water that the water came up and practically got me wet lying there on the stretcher, even though the stretcher was several inches off the ground. But anyway, it rain quit by morning, and all dried up, and the somebody's airplane wouldn't work, and these two fools flew back, two of them in one P-40. That was Griff and Chandler. One of them sat on the other one's lap and came back one airplane. I had word from home that a cousin of mine, a man named Fred Blackburn, was stationed somewhere near me in New Guinea. He was an enlisted man with a bomb group. I had undoubtedly met him at one time or another, but I certainly really didn't know him. His family lived up near Fredericksburg or someplace, but I knew who he was, and I got a jeep one afternoon, I remember, and went over to his squadron and asked for him, and they told me where he was, and I finally found him out beside the road digging a ditch or doing something or other. I suppose he knew who I was, but he seemed quite uncomfortable and embarrassed, and I found him very hard to talk to, and I did the best I could, but it's the only time I saw him. Of course, he was friendly and nice and all that, but incidentally, I had, as you know, I had seen my cousin Blackie Cosby. Well, he was as much kin to Blackie as he was to me, but I don't think that Blackie ever went to see him. Probably didn't even know he was there. One day we were sent to sit alert over at Port Moresby and ended up spending the night over there, the whole squadron, because of weather, I guess. It poured rain all night, and the next morning we had to get up early and hurry back home where we belonged. And I remember that day because it poured rain all night and everything was soaking wet. And the visibility in the morning was incredibly clear. The visibility was unlimited. No, not a cloud in the sky. And we climbed over the mountain and then scooted down the other side, not terribly far off the treetops. And you could smell the whole wet jungle. The smell came reeking up. And the sun gleamed on the airplanes and the propellers flashed, and you could just tell, you could feel that everybody in the whole squadron was very happy and excited, and it was a very beautiful sight, and smelled good, and the air was fine, and we were just eager to go somewhere and do something. I don't remember that we did, but we were ready. People sometimes ask, weren't you scared? Well, you have to remember all these things took place over nearly a year and a half, and you don't feel the same 2 days in a row. And some days you're scared, some days you get up, you aren't ready for anything. That's still true. Other days you get up and it wouldn't matter what happened to you. You'd be ready for it. On an average day, you're somewhere in between that. But whatever it is, you get used to it. Early in November, the bombing people put on a huge raid up in Rabaul, and they sent practically every bomber they had up there, which were a lot by this time, if you counted those B-25s and all. But a certain number of B-25s and P-38s were lost on the way home, and that was mostly an overwater flight for them. And the next morning, the weather was sort of iffy with rain squalls here and there and cloud banks here and there. But anyway, we were sent up to go search the sea and see if we couldn't find some of those guys. We were hoping they would be in life rafts somewhere and we could locate them. So the whole squadron took off, and but we went different ways. It didn't really stick together, and weren't supposed to, because we cover more ground by not doing so. Um, Anyway, I decided that since everybody else was going to go hunting around over the open ocean, that perhaps some of those crews might well have made it ashore and be waiting along the shore, and that I would search the coastline up and down. And that's what I did. None of us ever sighted anybody or anything, but anyway, I was entirely separated from everybody else except my wingman who was with me. Finally came time that I had to go home, and I turned around, and as I proceeded west, I found that there was a solid cloud bank between me and the shore. And as best I could estimate, this cloud bank was simply forcing me farther and farther out to sea. I didn't dare turn south and fly through it because, for all I knew, I would end up in the mountainside or something. As it turned out, it was clear on the other side of that cloud bank, but I didn't know that. Well, about this time, the Air Force had installed a homing station at Dobadura and had given us instructions on how to use it. So it seemed to me that this was an ideal time to call on their assistance, which I did. And they came right on the air and told me that the weather was all right there once I got through the clouds and to turn to such and such a heading and go on. That's what I did, and my wingman, of course, who was with me, did the same thing. And we flew through the cloud bank and came out and finally got to the coast and back to the base and landed. Well, that goddamned Aubrey, who was operations officer, was pissed off about the thing, and he said, the mistake you made was ever leaving here in the first place. You should have just stayed here if you were going to get lost. And I said, well, I wasn't lost. And he said, you've disgraced us. You've disgraced us. You called on that homing station to get you back. Makes us look like fools. And I said, well, I don't know what good the homing station is. You're not going to make use of it. And I said, if I'd flown into those clouds and they'd been solid all the way in, I'd flew into the mountainside, you wouldn't have thought much of that. Well, he said, you shouldn't have gone at all. You should have just stayed home. And he was pissed with me, and I was pissed with him. I never liked him after that. I didn't like him before very much, but I detested him after that. Fortunately, he went home soon after then, and I wasn't sorry to see him go either. After that, old Aubrey was a flight leader, and when he went home, I inherited his flight. So I then became, had a flight of my own. So far on this, these tapes that I can't always remember what I've said and what I haven't. But perhaps I haven't said this. Sometime, while we were at Dobadura, Sid Woods, who was now the CO of the 9th Squadron with P-38s, came over to see me, and he said he wanted me to transfer to the 9th Squadron and fly P-38s, and he said, I'll give you your own flight, and I want you over there with us, and I'll see that the transfer is taken care of. I can arrange it. And it was a hard thing for me to do because I dearly wanted to fly P-38s. But I had to tell him that I preferred not to do that. Mainly because most of the people that I used to know in the 9th Squadron had already gone home, and their places had been taken by people I didn't know at all. And in the second place, I was beginning to feel very much at home not only in the 7th Squadron, but also in the P-40, something I thought would never happen. And I simply didn't want to break all those ties and begin new ones in a strange setting. And I had to tell him no. And I'm sure that his feelings were somewhat hurt, because it was a very generous offer he made me, and one which he was not compelled to do at all. But in the years since, thinking about it, I'm sure I made the right decision. I don't. I think that the thing to do was to stay where I was, and that's what I did do. And another factor there, incidentally, was that I knew perfectly well Sid was going home to the States very soon, and I'd hardly get established over there in the 9th Squadron again before he'd gone, and I'd be left alone with all those comparative strangers.